Hello and welcome to the Gandhara, the podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Pakistan and Afghanistan. I'm Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. The ongoing fighting in Iraq and Syria is the worst of the battles the Middle East has seen in its recent history. There are various clashing interests in the battle, and therefore there are many actors. Perhaps very little known, but among those players are also Afghan fighters. Those Afghan fighters are mainly consist of illegal Afghan refugees in Iran, and in Syria they are called Fatemiyun Brigade. They are reportedly attracted to the battle in exchange of various incentives by Tehran. Their numbers vary depend on what source you look at, but it is significant. Therefore, some analysts even say that the brigade might be the foundation for another Hezbollah in Afghanistan. So there are many short and long-term questions about these Afghan fighters. First, let's find out who those fighters are and what role they are playing in the battlefield. Obviously, the bigger question would be, what is next for them and also for Iran, which we will discuss in the second half of the show. So to discuss all this, I'm joined by Ahmed Majidyar, a senior fellow and the director of Iran Observed Project at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. Ahmed Shuja is also joining us, who is an Afghan analyst with in-depth knowledge of the Fatemiyun. Abu Bakr Siddiq, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Gandhara website, is joining us. The site looks into Pakistan in Afghanistan. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
So let's start with you, Ahmed. We have two Ahmeds today. So Ahmed Majidyar, I was reading your fascinating piece on Fatemiyun dating back to earlier this year. First, let's nail down the number. Iranian media is kind of convinced that the Afghan fighters to be around 18,000, at least until earlier this year. So any changes since then?
Well, we don't have the exact numbers of the Fatemiyun fighters or the Afghan fighters that fight alongside the IRGC and Hezbollah in Syria. But according to different accounts that I've seen in the Iranian media, state-run media, and also some numbers provided by members of the IRGC or government officials, the number ranges from anything from 10,000 to 20,000. And one senior IRGC official earlier this year said that about 18,000 Afghan fighters are currently fighting in Syria. But we don't know if all that 18,000 are inside Syria at one time, or he was talking about the overall number fighting in Syria on a rotation basis.
Ahmed Shuja, what does your sources say about these numbers?
I think Mr. Majidyar is correct in his assessment in that there are no concrete figures available of the number of fighters in Afghan fighters in Syria. The 18,000 that we've heard, the military official quote, could be the number that has fought over the last few years in total in Syria, or it could be the one-time strength at any given moment in Syria. So I think the safe bet, it's a rather long range, but the safe bet is sometime between 10 to 20,000 fighters, because the Fatemiyun was actually upgraded from a Lewa to a Lashkar, and a Lashkar typically has between 15 to 20,000 fighters in it.
Oh, okay. So
yeah, and if I can quickly add that, regardless of whether it is 10,000 or 20,000, the Afghan fighters still constitute the largest single militia group fighting in Syria under the IRGC. It's even bigger in number than Hezbollah, which is estimated to have about 5,000 or 6,000 fighters inside Syria.
So the biggest question is then who these people are, these Afghan fighters are. Abu Bakr, feel free to jump in, and also Ahmed, Majidyar, and Shuja, whoever wants to take this question.
Sure, I can briefly just talk about it. Indeed, Iran helped form the Fatemiyun Brigade in 2012. To prop up the embattled regime of Bashar al-Assad. At that time, it was very much small in number. Of course, that grew by time. But the relations of the Afghan Shiite fighters with the IRGC dates back all the way to the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s. because about 2,000 Afghans died in that fight, and many of their commander, they stayed with the IRGC as official or non-official members of the IRGC since then. That group, Afghan group at that time, was called Abu Zar Brigade. Mm-hmm. And then later in the 1990s, Iran also formed another Afghan Shiite brigade called Sepah-e Muhammad, or the Muhammad Brigade. Purpose of that was to fight the Taliban. So most of the founders of the Fatimiyun, or the commanders, early commanders, most of them have died now, have been killed in Syria. They were those who fought under the IRGC in the 90s and also in the 1980s.
If I may add something as well to what Mr. Majidiar just mentioned, there was also an Iranian-supported militia group in Karachi in the 1990s in Pakistan fighting a sectarian war there against Sepah-e Sahaba and others. So that's a separate issue there. It's supported by Iran. A lot of the fighters fighting in Syria actually have nothing to do in terms of historic ties with IRGC. They are immigrants, undocumented refugees, economic migrants who are in Iran, and because of their vulnerable position, are easy to convince and or force to go and fight in Syria. And so the bulk, in fact, the vast, vast majority of these fighters are very young, in their 20s, some of them, as we've learned, in their teenage years, some in their 30s, who have actually been born and raised and lived in Iran after the revolution, who are fighting in Syria. And there might be some ideological motivations there, but there are also other considerations stemming from their vulnerable position in Iran.
So they were vulnerable. Abu Bakr, I was coming to you. Now, there are fighters who joined the either Fatimiyun or under any other name in Syria from the Iranian side, people who came from Pakistan. They were not in Iran, and they were not in a position where the Afghan undocumented refugees are. So why did the fighters from Pakistan came all the way to Syria to join Iran?
Well, the Pakistanis are apparently organized in a separate formation called the Zenabiyun. And I think most of them, from what we know from Iranian media, I mean government media, because they frequently cover these funerals for these people or their families meeting Iranian officials. There is this famous video of Ayatollah Khamenei meeting some of the families of the Afghan fighters.
Yeah.
And kind of blessing them and praising them. So in terms of Pakistan, there have been reports of people being recruited on social media, Facebook ads. And most of these people come from the tribal areas. Among the Pashtuns in tribal areas, there's one tribe and some other clans of two other tribes that are the Turi tribe in Parachinar. And the Turi tribe has a long history of being a victim of Sunni extremist militancy, being in this picturesque valley in tribal area surrounded by Sunni population. They were most recently, they fought this long battle where they were besieged for 4 years. And also having, I mean, this kind of, there is this talk of Hezbollah of Pakistan, because the fighters from that region, unlike Afghanistan, appear to be traveling out of their will, or maybe because of the networking. We know from 1990s, even going back to 1980s, that this larger Shia-Sunni conflict kind of emerged after the Iranian Revolution. And on one hand, you have the Salafi Wahhabis led by Saudi Arabia government or non-government actors in Saudi Arabia. And then on the other hand, you have the Shia hardliners led by Iran. And this sectarian war has actually kind of being a prominent feature of many of the wars in across the Islamic world, be that Syria, be that the sectarian conflict in Pakistan. In Afghanistan, luckily, sectarianism has never been a major part of the warfare, although during the Taliban times, the Shia minority was targeted. They suffered heavily. And now, apparently, the IS is claiming credit for some of these horrific attacks against Shia civilians.
If I may quickly just also add to what Abu Bakr said, that scores of Pakistani Shiites also travel to Iran on an annual basis for pilgrimage and also to visit Iranian, to Shiite secret shrines and sites. And also many of them just go to Qom, the holy city of Qom as well. So that also provide a an opportunity for the Revolutionary Guards to recruit some of them. And as Shuja just mentioned before, that the Iranian government has been exploiting the vulnerability of a lot of Afghans. But when it comes to the Pakistani Shiites, there is also a lot of misinformation by the IRGC telling the Afghans and Pakistanis, very young Afghan and Pakistani Shiites indeed, that the fight in Syria is a sectarian war between the Sunnis and Shiites. So they will be going to Damascus to defend the shrines, the Shiite shrines. That's why they are called the defenders of shrine. But once they go there, then they are deployed to the battlefronts in faraway places.
Interesting. Follow-up question to Shuja. Earlier you mentioned, and also Ahmed Mejitiar, you hinted upon that Iran is kind of exploiting those undocumented refugees in Iran and sending them to Syria. And then Ahmed Mejitiar, in your piece, I have seen a section where you say that Iran's Quds forces or the Revolutionary Guards, you know, maintains an office in Afghanistan's Herat province, and they are also recruiting from there. So how to explain that?
As far as I understand, a lot of the recruitment actually happens through online propaganda videos, although in Kabul, in Mazar, I've spoken to former fighters who have fled the Fatemiyun to seek asylum and protection in Europe. I have spoken to former fighters who have returned to Afghanistan, and in many cases, I haven't personally not been able to track direct on-the-ground recruitment activities in Afghanistan, and it hasn't been tracked in other outlets of the media as well. But it is very likely that I've missed certain cues there as well. But maybe Mr. Mejitiar could enlighten us on that.
Yes, Ahmed, you sure. Mentioned in part of your reports that there were some arrests taken place by the Afghan authorities of members of Iranian Revolutionary Guards who were in the recruiting mission in Afghanistan. So, yeah, please, more details.
Sure. First, I agree fully with Shuja that most of the Fatemiyun fighters are recruited from the Afghan community living inside Iran. And Iran has offered a lot of rewards for them. First of all, it has relaxed restrictions, and at times even it has stopped deportation of unregistered Afghan to reward them for the Syrian war, because there are about 2.5 million Afghans living in Iran, and less than 1 million of them are registered as refugees. So the rest are economic migrants or illegal immigrants. So they are very vulnerable. And last year, Iran's parliament also approved a legislation that granted the government permission to give citizenship to non-Iranians who go and fight in Syria. There are also reports that some of the Afghans that have been imprisoned inside Iran on mostly on drugs charges, they have been given a deal that if they go and fight in Syria, their sentences would be reduced or they would be released. But there are also, as you mentioned, there are also reports that the IRGC has started recruitment of Afghan Shiites inside Afghanistan. Just to give you an example, last August, the Afghan government official said that they have arrested an Iranian official. His name was Qurban Ghalambor, who was allegedly recruiting Afghan fighters and sending them to Syria from Western Afghanistan. And the suspect was reportedly a representative of Iran's Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei. And there are also other reports that the Basij force, which is a pillar of the IRGC force, has opened a new headquarters in Herat, and they're indoctrinating and recruiting Afghans. And although the Afghan Hazara community, the vast majority of them, they have not joined Iran's war in Syria, there are a few clerics inside Afghanistan who are either on Iranian payroll or perhaps some of them even ideologically are close to the Iranian clerical establishment. They are actively justifying and propagating for a pan-Shiite jihad in Syria or the IRGC cause there.
So what the Afghan authorities are doing about this? I mean, they must be aware what's going on, right?
The Afghan government has at times raised concern about that, but Afghans are very careful when it comes to Iran. I personally asked two Afghan officials about this, and they said that we know about the issue, but we don't want to sour our relations with Iran at a time that relations with our other neighbor, Pakistan, is at an all-time low. But recently, especially after this Human Rights Watch report that said that Iran is recruiting Afghan children as young as 14 years old to fight in Syria, then the Afghan officials have become more vocal. We saw that the Afghan Foreign Ministry spokesman ask Iran not to incentivize or coerce Afghans to fight in Syria, not just children, but all Afghans. So there is a lot of resentment inside Afghanistan about that as well.
Mm. Abu Bakr, the same question to you. Actually, two questions. One is, you said the most of the fighting force that are coming from Pakistan to Syria to fight the Iranian battle, they are the Pashtuns from the Parachinar region. But you also have a Farsi-speaking Shiite in Quetta, Hazaras. So the fact that you did not mention maybe they are not joining the battle. And the second question is what the Pakistani authorities are doing about this Iranian recruitment, the fact that the Pakistani citizens are going to fight the Iran's battle in Syria.
Well, I would like to reinforce what Mr. Majidiar said, which is that there are these clerical networks. I mean, a lot of the Shia clergy around the world now looks towards Iran as a source of inspiration and also as a source of material help. These clerics and their organizations, some of them known, some of them secretive, have a role in the recruitment everywhere. Now, in terms of Pakistani response, I think the Pakistani response has been very firm. Pakistan has cracked down on elements. In January, I think this year, they banned one organization, I'm forgetting the name, something Hussein, in Parachinar, in Khurram, which is the district where Parachinar is the capital of that district. They declared it a banned organization. So Pakistan has always been very harsh on Shia militants linked to Iran inside Pakistan. Now, in terms of the Hazaras in Quetta, I think the Hazaras in Quetta are one of the most vulnerable communities in the past decade or so. They have suffered very huge, I mean, a large number of, they've been victims of constant terrorist attacks. Even now, when they, for example, if the Hazara shopkeepers and they go to the markets, they are taken under police protection. And I mean, just this week, there have been killings of Hazara civilians in Pakistan. So in that environment, it is difficult that a lot of Hazaras would like to go and fight in another country. We also have to remember that within Pakistani Hazara community in Quetta, there is now a very visible difference, and there is a lot of opposition to Iran's role in relations with the Shia clerics. There is a secular Hazara party in Quetta called the Hazara Democratic Party, which is opposed to everything the mullahs have been advocating, because in their view, the best course for them is to survive as Pakistani citizens in Balochistan and locals of Balochistan, and not as a part of some kind of transnational Shia network or Shia community. In Afghanistan, I think I will add to what Majidiar said, is that I think in Afghanistan there's a lot of sensitivity around Iran, because the Afghan authorities, partners in this current coalition government or national unity government, would not like to, in a way, point out Hazaras as the allies of Iran or some kind, or blame them for bringing Iranian influence or whatever, backers of Iran. But we have to remember that the only politician that has pointed out or clearly spoken about this is Gulbadin Hikmatyar, the leader of hardline Islamist Hizb-e-Islami, who reconciled with Kabul this year. But I think his speech was by and large not liked by the Afghan intelligentsia, and I think that within Afghan Hazara community, again, there is a lot of difference of opinion. Maybe the older generation, those associated with the anti-Soviet and anti-Taliban resistance, are trying to go into one direction, but the younger generation wants to take another direction.
Okay.
Yeah, if I may add very quickly.
Yeah, please, very quickly.
Add to what was said here. The Hazara community in Quetta, like Abu Bakr said, is under assault, and it has been under assault for over a decade now. It's moving into the second decade, and as Human Rights Watch called it in 2015, they live in a ghetto lifestyle, and they've found it extremely difficult in Pakistan to organize their own community self-defense. This community that's under assault does not find itself capable of going into Iran and fighting as part of the Pakistani Shia Brigade of Zainab Yun fighting in Syria. Now, a similar sentiment is propping up in parts of Afghanistan. There has always been, even since the 1990s and the 80s, an opposition or an aversion towards cozying up with Iran among certain parts of the Hazara population in Afghanistan, and not just the clerics and not just the, quote, traditional leaders. This opposition has been ongoing since the times of Mazari and others in Afghanistan, and it is getting stronger. It is not downplaying; it's not waning. But the biggest fertile ground that Iran has in any Shia community outside of its borders is really through its religious ties with the clerics in these communities. That these religious ties gives Iran. Because Iran is Qom is a religious authority, one of the two major nuclei of Shiite clerical spiritual learning, that gives them natural inroads into the clerical establishments outside of Iran, but also a legitimacy that they can then use for their political ends in these communities. So there are oppositions within Shia communities in Iran and in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, but particularly it's growing and increasing. And now the biggest inroads Iran can make is through the clerical establishment in these communities.
Okay.
And if I may just quickly add to what Shuja and Abu Bakr say, I think that they're right that because the Shiite communities in Pakistan and recently now in Afghanistan as well, as long as they remain vulnerable to discrimination, violence, and terrorism, some of them would be prone to Iran's political exploitation because so far a great majority of Pakistan's Shia community, the same in Afghanistan, have shown remarkable patience. They have resisted Iranian interference. They have rejected violence and they have continued to be part of mainstream political parties. But as the tide of attacks against the Shiites rise in Pakistan, and also recently we've seen systematic attacks against the Shiites in Afghanistan as well, and also we see the government's inability or at times unwillingness to tackle the problem, that leave young Shiites vulnerable to radicalization and foreign meddling.
Okay, thank you very much, Ahmed Mejitiar. So as some members of Shiite community joining the Iranian side in the battle, some Sunni groups from the region are joining the opposite side in the battle and fighting against each other in Syria. And this tension also increasingly reflected on the ground. At least this is what you suggest, Ahmed Mejitiar, in your report. So now, as Syria battlefield is increasingly drying up, what lies ahead for these fighters, for those Afghan fighters and Pakistani fighters, and what are Iran's future plans about them? So we will continue the discussion talking about this and many other questions shortly. Hey everyone, before we get into the second part of the show, just a quick reminder that if you really like Gandhara podcast, there's a real chance that you will also like my other radio show that's called Majlis podcast. The show discusses latest developments in Central Asia from local perspective. And the podcast is published every week, most probably Saturdays, on Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website. It's a totally must-follow discussion for foreign policy nerds with interest in the region. First, let me recap the debate that today on Gandhara, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's podcast focusing on Pakistan and Afghanistan. We are discussing the involvement of Afghan and Pakistani fighters in Syrian battlefield and Iran's rule behind it. Joining me in the discussion are Ahmed Khalid Mejitiar, Senior Fellow and the Director of Iran Observatory Project at the Middle East Institute, Ahmed Shuja, an Afghan analyst with in-depth knowledge of the Fatemiyun, Abu Bakr Siddiq, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Gandhara website. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Gandhara podcast here in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, gentlemen. So Let's go to the background, Ahmed Mejitiar, before we look forward. I think a similar group of Afghan fighters exist during the Iran-Iraq war. So what happened to them, and what does that group say about the future of Fatemiyoun?
Well, that group, those groups are, especially their leaders that fought alongside the IRGC against Iraq in the 1980s or fought Iran's war against the Taliban in the 1990s. Many of them have retired, or a younger generation of them that fought as commanders of the Fatemiyoun in Syria, they have been killed in Syria. So as Shuja rightly mentioned before, that right now the majority of the Fatemiyoun militants fighting inside Syria, they are very young Afghans fighting there. But what is worrying is that, as you mentioned before, that we already see the spillover effects of the Afghans fighting in Syria on both sides, on the government side and also Afghan and Pakistani Sunnis that fight on the with the opposition and some of them even with terrorist groups on the other side. We all already see that its implications on sectarian violence in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And also another dangerous trend that we see is that many Iranian officials, for example, Ismail Qani, who is the deputy commander of the Iran's Quds Force, and the Quds Force is Iran's elite force that is commanding all these militias in Iraq and Syria and elsewhere. He very openly speak at some of the funeral ceremonies of these Fatemiyoun fighters that Fatemiyoun's mission is not confined only to Syria. Once the Syria war is over, they would be deployed to other conflicts in the region and fight for Islam, fight for the religion. So it is definitely a very long-term project that Iran is working on, the Fatemiyoun.
Do you see any indication of where this is going after Syria?
Well, right now, Fatemiyoun is very much closely linked with the Lebanese Hezbollah. Most of these Fatemiyoun militants, they receive a pre-deployment, very short training inside Iran, and then they go to the battlefield. But then inside Syria, they are mostly trained by Hezbollah and sometimes by Iraqi militias as well. So there is, we see a trans-regional connection between the Fatemiyoun and other Shiite networks. And there are right now, recent reports indicate that Fatemiyoun have been deployed to southeast Syria alongside Hezbollah and other Iraqi Shiite militants. So another front could be against Israel in southern Syria. There are also reports that some Fatemiyoun have been deployed to Yemen, but we don't have any verification of those reports.
Okay, Shuja, Ahmed Shuja. So two points emerging from Ahmed Mejitiar's point. One is about the what's next for Iran. What's Iran's plan about these battlefields? And any indication, how do you see where they are, the Afghan fighters, going, what they are doing, what role Iran might be playing with that, and any indication in that that's happening?
Mr. Mejitiar is actually correct in that what Iran is developing on the backs of these vulnerable Afghan refugees and economic migrants is really a long-term militant proxy asset with skills that are hardened in battle. And as we've seen with the contribution of Afghan fighters in what Iran calls the holy defense against the Iraqis when Saddam was in power, those structures were disbanded but not completely melted away. Informal connections with these commanders and their fighters still existed between Iran and the commanders and the fighters who fought in this war. And it is likely that if, and this is a huge if because we don't know what the future direction of the Middle Eastern conflict is going to go in what direction it's going to go, but if the Fatemiyoun is disbanded, the repository of experience and knowledge and training is going to be very hard for Iran to give away. There will be connections and links, particularly as a lot of the families of these fighters are now being settled not in Afghanistan, but in Iran itself, given citizenships to long-term residences, and the connections are being deepened now. Iran would continue to use this proxy asset, if not in Afghanistan, but in other parts of the world as well, because it has invested time and energy and money, and these fighters are battle-hardened and religiously motivated. And Iran, the whole concept of Wilayat al-Faqih is that it transcends the borders of Iran, and that the reign of the cleric Ayatollahs actually aren't confined to only the Shias in Iran. And so that concept is applicable to the Fatimiyyin as well.
Abu Bakr, what's your thought on this? And also, how do you see the end game for those hundreds or thousands of Pakistani fighters who are now in Syrian battlefield?
Well, I think we also have to remember that the IGRC or Iranian government's covert destabilization efforts now, I think, even transcend Shias, because in Afghanistan, they've been backing the Taliban. In recent months, there are reports that we have reported that in the western provinces of Afghanistan, particularly in Farah, the IGRC or Quds Force operatives are training local Sunni militants to fight against ISS or Islamic State fighters. So, I mean, clearly this Iranian game of using militant proxies, non-state actors, is going to continue for some time. In Pakistan, I think as a minority, and I think that's also true for Afghanistan, most Shia communities from any ethnicity, any class, any part of the country are interested in living a normal life, be part of the national fabric, and they expect their states and their respective governments to protect them from Sunni extremism. I'll give you one example. I think whenever Iran and Saudi Arabia primarily, and then their respective allies in the greater Muslim world, try to build some kind, engage in some kind of confidence building and some kind of conflict resolution, we will see a dramatic reduction in sectarianism between the Shias and the Sunnis. And also, of course, then there'll be little use for these kinds of elements.
Yeah, we are almost out of time. Just some final notes here. Yes, there are many questions, many elements that we have to focus on Syria and the Middle East and Iraq. But in general, there is not much of discussion about this element, the Afghan fighters, in what Iran is doing about them and what might follow later. How we are missing this in the West?
Yeah, I think that you're very right. First of all, there is not much information about the role of Fatimiyyin and also the network it has established with the regional Shiite militant groups, especially with the Lebanese Hezbollah and also the Iraqi paramilitary Shiite forces. It's important for the United States and its allies not to ignore the danger of sectarianism in Pakistan and also the growing violence against the Shiites in Afghanistan as well, because these Sunni sectarian groups in Pakistan, they are not only massacring Pakistani Shias and also now recently in Afghanistan as well, but they also have established very close linkages with Al-Qaeda and other regional and international terrorist organizations and are actively involved in terrorist attacks against India as well. So if they are left unchecked, this Sunni Shiite violence could further destabilize nuclear-armed Pakistan, and that could have dangerous ramifications for regional stability, America, and national security. And similarly, if Afghan Shiites are left vulnerable, that could destabilize Afghanistan as well and could damage the sectarian harmony that we've had in Afghanistan despite decades of war in the past.
Ahmed Shujab, is there anything the Afghan authorities can do about this, like the fact that there are thousands of undocumented Afghan refugees being deployed there, and then there are big, big questions about what might follow when the Syrian battlefield dries up?
It's difficult to say what the Afghan authorities have been doing behind the scenes, even though they have not been outspoken in the media or publicly otherwise. The power asymmetry in this equation, given that there are 2.5 to 3 million Afghan refugees living in Iran, one, and number two, that the Afghan government is hoping to secure some form of Iranian cooperation in any eventual settlement or peace process in Afghanistan, number two, are points of leverage that I think limit the ability of the Afghan government to bring this issue up forcefully with Iran. However, there is a major human rights element to the process. Using vulnerable refugees, children under the age of 15 and children under the age of 18 to fight in Syria are points of leverage that the Afghan government could use through its international allies, including the governments in Europe, Germany and France, some of whom are actually in the UN Human Rights Council. Afghanistan is seeking membership in the UN Human Rights Council. Those international venues are places where this issue could come up, if not directly from the Afghan government, but through some of its international allies fighting in Afghanistan, offering aid to Afghanistan, who have a stake in the stability of Afghanistan now and into the future. And the presence of continued militancy and potential for sectarian flashpoint will be developments that are adverse to the aims of the NATO and RS mission in Afghanistan. So those member countries in RS and in NATO that have been investing in Afghanistan for years, who are likely to see their gains evaporate because of the potential sectarian flashpoint in the country, could use venues such as the UN Human Rights Council and other venues to which Afghanistan has access or is planning to have access as potential points of leverage if the Afghan government really wants to focus on this issue. But we don't know what they've done so far behind the scenes.
Okay. On Pakistan, Abu Bakr, what Pakistan should be doing going forward to deal with the situation as, you know, hundreds of its citizens is already in Syria.
Well, I think Pakistan has always been in a very difficult position regarding Iran and Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is one of its key allies, and it employs a lot of Pakistani. Pakistani economy depends on a lot of the remittances and aid and other things from Saudi Arabia. But Iran is its neighbor. Pakistan shares a border with Iran and also shares this sensitive region of Balochistan, which is the largest province in Iran, Sistan Balochistan in the southeast, and the largest province in Pakistan, the southwestern province of Balochistan. I mean, that's why Pakistan didn't join the war in Yemen. Pakistan has kind of been doing this tightrope walk. Domestically, I think Pakistan, it's not really a huge issue, because even if these fighters come back to Pakistan, they will go to their region in tribal areas where they've already been fighting Sunni militants for years. I think Pakistan can easily reintegrate them, or maybe I'm sure that there were some reports that they've been arresting these people. Sources from the region have told me that people who go to Syria, even if they come back, they try to keep an extremely low profile because of the fear of punishment from the government. I think for Pakistan, it's not, because in Pakistan, the major domestic terrorism threat emanates from mostly Sunni groups, not Shia groups. The Shia groups are by and large more of a reaction sort of things. So in Pakistan, I don't think it's kind of like one of the top national security issues, but Islamabad needs to be more proactive in reaching out to both Tehran and Saudi Arabia and trying to convince them to engage in some kind of peace building between them, because their proxy wars are destructive for everyone.
Right. Okay, thank you very much, Abu Bakr Siddiq, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Gandhara website. And big thanks goes to Ahmed Khalid Majidyar, a fellow and the director of Iran Observed Project at the Middle East Institute, and Ahmed Shuja, an Afghan analyst who has tracked the Fatemiyoun issue for years. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
This is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Gandhara podcast in Washington, D.C. Until next week. Bye-bye.